When activist lawyer Brian Stevenson was 9 years old, his grandmother, a woman whose parents had been slaves, asked him to promise her that he would always do the right thing, no matter how hard. And for the last 30 years, he's tried, starting the Alabama-based Equal Justice Initiative and getting more than 140 people off death row. His memoir, Just Mercy, is now a film that exposes deep racism in the American criminal justice system. He says America needs to confront its past, connecting slavery, segregation, and the lynchings of African Americans to modern mass incarceration and discrimination. And Brian Stevenson joins me now. Hello there.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Yeah, nice to chat to you. The movie focuses on one of your cases. It's a black man wrongly convicted of killing a white woman. And there were so many obstacles in your way in that case. And I wonder, is your grandmother on your shoulder when you take on cases that seem hopeless?
She absolutely is. I've always believed that I am standing on the shoulders of people who did so much more with so much less. The history of struggle in our country is difficult, but it can also be empowering. As you mentioned, my great-grandparents were enslaved. My grandparents fled the American South when lynching took place. I started my education in a colored school because they didn't let black kids go to the public school. And throughout that, I've always been taught by my grandmother and others that you have to believe things you haven't seen, that your hope is your superpower, and that hopelessness is the enemy of justice. And that has certainly shaped my career, and it's one of the things that I hope people will pick up when they see the film. I mean, we have the highest rate of incarceration in the world in the U.S. We have a system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. And to combat that, you have to be willing to believe things you haven't seen. You have to have an orientation to kind of stand up even when people say sit down, and to speak even when people say be quiet. And I certainly got that from my grandmother.
So Walter McMillan was on death row in Alabama for 6 years based on manufactured witnesses and evidence. He's played by Jamie Foxx in the movie, and he says, when you're black in the South, you're guilty from the moment you're born. It's a great line. Is it true?
I think it is true. I mean, we obviously are still recovering from the legacy of slavery in this country for 250 years. We enslaved black people, but worse than that, we created this narrative where we said that black people aren't as good as white people. Black people aren't fully human. They're not evolved. And that narrative of racial difference created an ideology of white supremacy. We passed the 13th Amendment in America in 1865, which was intended to end slavery, and it prohibits involuntary servitude and forced labor, but it doesn't say anything about ending this narrative of racial difference, this ideology of white supremacy. And because of that, I don't think slavery actually ended in America in 1865. I think it just evolved. It turned into decades of racial violence and terrorism. This presumption of dangerousness and guilt was assigned to black and brown people. And even after the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the progress that we have made, there still is that presumption that gets assigned to people who are black or brown. And it doesn't matter how talented you are, how gifted you are, how hardworking you are. And Walter McMillan, the person I defend in the film, was convicted because he was presumed guilty. He wasn't presumed innocent. A presumption of innocence would have shielded him from a wrongful conviction based on manufactured evidence. But because he was presumed guilty, he was convicted and then sentenced to death in the very same community, by the way, where Harper Lee grew up and wrote the famed and beloved American novel, To Kill a Mockingbird. And that community loves that story. They romanticize the story. They celebrate the story. And yet we're comfortable with this wrongful conviction. And so I do think this presumption of dangerousness and guilt that we assign to black and brown people, to immigrants, to people who are different, to people who have been othered, is one of the real challenges that we are facing in our nation at this time.
It's an incredible coincidence that it happened in Monroeville, the home of To Kill a Mockingbird. And as you say, the townspeople are very proud of that story. And yet the reality is that the town re-elected Sheriff Tom Tate kept re-electing him until he retired last year, a man who pressured witnesses to testify against McMillan. I mean, what does that say about where the town's heart really is?
Well, I think it just speaks to this divide, this disconnect we have. I mean, our nation had a constitution that talked about equal justice for all, liberty and justice for all. We've always had words on paper that had these aspirations that cannot be reconciled to enslaving other people or disenfranchising people because of their race or color or creating up legal structures of apartheid and racial segregation. None of it has been consistent with the laws and the doctrine that we espouse. And so it's getting past that disconnect that is the challenge that we face. And I think what happens is that, you know, you have politicians and elected leaders who preach the politics of fear and anger. And when we're governed by fear and anger, we tolerate things we shouldn't tolerate. We accept things that can't be reconciled with the stories we've told each other about who we are and the laws that we've passed. And I do think it allows people to get comfortable with things they should never get comfortable with. And it's not unique to the U.S. I think all over the world, there will always be voices preaching fear and anger, and they will want fear and anger to cause people to retreat from being fair and just with everyone, treating everybody with respect, giving people their basic rights. And that's what happened in this case. Fear and anger over a crime caused the community to not do what the law requires, despite that legacy and connection to the story of To Kill a Mockingbird. And it's, for me, one of the takeaways of the film and the story and the book is that we have to be people who are prepared to fight against the narratives of fear and anger that will cause us to be unjust.
And at the end of the movie, there's a quote that for every 9 people who've been executed in the U.S., 1 person on death row has been exonerated and released. That's a shocking rate of error. And why does America have one of the highest rates of capital punishment in the world?
Yeah, I mean, it is a shocking rate of error. And I think it just speaks to, again, the way we can disconnect. I mean, if somebody said for every 9 apples in a grocery store, 1, if you touch it, we'll kill you, we would stop selling apples. We would never accept that kind of threat. But somehow in our culture and in our country, we've tolerated this abusive punishment. I do think it has to do, mass incarceration in America, with this kind of this fear and anger. We said that people in the 70s and 80s who are drug addicted and drug dependent, we said that those people are criminals. And we're going to use the criminal justice system to respond to that problem, when we should have said that addiction and dependency is a health problem and we need our healthcare system to help people. But by using punishment as the prescription for everything, we just kept adding more and more people to our jails and prisons, and the death penalty became kind of the buckle on that belt that we used indiscriminately. And now we have a system that is defined by error. I think there are thousands of innocent people in our jails and prisons in America. You can't go from a prison population of 200,000 in 1972 to 2.2 million without making a lot of mistakes.
Wow.
You haven't invested in fairness and reliability. So I think it's one of the challenges of this era. And I do think it has global implications, because in other parts of the world you hear these same voices that want to just get tough and not actually try to understand the nature of the problems that we see in our communities and urban centers in particular.
I'm speaking with activist lawyer Brian Stevenson, who founded the Alabama-based Equal Justice Initiative, and his memoir Just Mercy is now a film that exposes the racism in the American criminal justice system. That title, Just Mercy, have you put any thoughts, Brian, into when mercy is just?
Well, I absolutely believe that we are all more than the worst thing we've ever done. I think if somebody tells a lie, they're not just a liar. If someone takes something, they're not just a thief. I think even if you kill someone, you're not just a killer. And justice requires that we understand the other things you are. And a system without mercy doesn't actually look to understand who people are. You know, we have prisons all over the world. We have criminal justice systems all over the world. And we have policymakers debating punishment all over the world. And sometimes people act as if we can put crimes in prison. But we don't put crimes in prison. We put people in prison. And people are not crimes. People may commit crimes, but we have to understand that relationship. And I just think I see systems that act with no capacity for mercy, no capacity for understanding, no interest in wanting to understand the context and circumstances. And a system that is absent of mercy is going to be a system that is fundamentally unjust, that is unfair. I mean, we all want mercy. I mean, that's kind of what I was trying to get at when I wrote the book. We all want the opportunity to recover when we make a mistake, when we say something that's wrong, when we offend. We don't want to be defined by that. We don't want our life and our purpose and our opportunities to be ended because we made those mistakes. We value mercy, but we can't expect that if we're unwilling to give that to the people around us. Just mercy is the kind of mercy that we give to others, even if they don't deserve it, because we're going to want it for ourselves when we don't deserve it. And the beauty of mercy is that it allows us to actually understand our humanity and our capacity for redemption and recovery in ways that when we're just condemning people and reducing people to their worst acts, we don't get to see. I've, you know, represented a lot of people during my career. I've never met anybody about whom I could say this person's life has no meaning or purpose or value. I meet people who, because of illness and disability and other challenges, are going to need a lot of help. They may even need to be isolated, but I've never met anybody about whom I could say this person's life has no purpose or meaning. And a society without mercy will confuse the crimes that people commit with the people themselves, and that confusion will cause us to treat each other unjustly.
When you look around the world, do you see places where the past is confronted honestly?
Yeah, I think there are places where there have been more meaningful efforts at repair. If you go to Johannesburg, there is the Apartheid Museum. It's a powerful space for truth-telling, and there's a consciousness. Their constitutional court in South Africa is surrounded by iconography that is designed to make sure that people don't forget the injustice of apartheid when they go into that space. In Kigali, in Rwanda, there's a genocide museum that's designed to make sure that everyone understands what that nation went through during that horrible period. For most Rwandans, it's imperative that if you come to that country that you leave with some understanding of the trauma and terror of the genocide. I've been to Berlin, and when I walk around Berlin, you can't go 200 meters without seeing symbols or stones or markers or monuments that are dedicated to the lives of people who were killed during the Holocaust. And most Germans want you to go to the Holocaust Memorial, because they're trying to change the narrative. They don't want to be thought of as fascists and Nazis. They want the narrative to change. There are no Adolf Hitler statues in Germany. But in the United States, we don't talk about the Native genocide, what we did to Native people, indigenous people on this continent. We don't talk about slavery. We don't talk about lynching. We don't talk about segregation. I live in the American South, where the landscape is littered with the iconography of the Confederacy. In my state of Alabama, we actually celebrate Jefferson Davis's birthday as a state holiday. He was the president of the Confederacy that tried to preserve slavery. The Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday, and we haven't acknowledged this history. So I do think there are places around the world where there has been this reckoning with the past, and I think those places are experiencing recovery that we haven't experienced here. I think we wouldn't think about Germany today the way we think about them if they were still unwilling to acknowledge the horrors of the Nazi era. If you saw swastikas everywhere you went, if people talk romantically about Hitler and that regime, I don't think we could get to the same place that we've gotten to. And I think that's part of what the problem is when you have nations that have not committed to an era of truth and justice after horrific periods of human rights violations.
So have you applied what you saw overseas to the National Memorial for Peace and Justice and Legacy Museum? You opened that in Montgomery, Alabama, 2 years ago.
Yes, we have, and I hope listeners will visit us in Montgomery, Alabama, because we have created sites that we're very proud of, the Legacy Museum.
Well, I think you've had more than 650,000 visitors already, so it's obviously been a tremendous success.
That's right. Yes, we're really, really excited about people's response to the spaces, and people leave and they say, I didn't know, I feel changed. It's really powerful. It speaks to what art and culture can do to impact people's thinking. And I've had that same response to people who saw the film, which is also very affirming. I do think there's a role for art and culture and narrative in helping communities and societies recover from horrific violence and tragedy and human rights violations. And we're certainly trying to create that in Montgomery with our museum and our memorial and the cultural spaces that we've opened.
One of the things you've got in the museum are jars of soil taken from lynching sites. And, I mean, it's unbelievable, really, when you think about the fact that people are alive today who took part in those lynchings. How do you even wrap your head around that?
Yeah, no, it's been really powerful to engage people today and going to these spaces where these lynchings took place. And, you know, what I love about it is it gives people an opportunity to do something tangible. And we do have hundreds of these jars with the soil collected at the sites of these lynchings with the names of victims and the dates. And, you know, we had a collection recently where an older black woman went to a site and she was very nervous and afraid, and she was out on the roadside about to dig the soil, and a white man drove by in a truck, and he stared at her, and she got afraid. And the man stopped the truck, and he walked over to where she was, and he said, "What are you doing?" And we tell people they don't have to acknowledge what they're doing when they're out doing it if they're afraid. And she was going to tell this man, "I'm just getting some soil for my garden." But then she told me that something got a hold of her. And when that man asked her that question, she said, "I'm digging soil because this is where a black man was lynched in 1937, and I want to honor his life." And she began digging the soil very quickly because she didn't know what the man was going to do or say. But the man stood there, and then he said, "Does that paper talk about the lynching? We give each person a memo that describes the lynching." And she said, "It does." And then he said, "Can I read it?" And so she gave the man the paper. And the man stood there reading while she began digging the soil. And then after the man finished reading the paper and read about the horror of that lynching, he put the paper down and shocked this woman by saying, "Would it be okay if I helped you?" And she said, "That would be wonderful." And the man got down on his knees, and she was going to give him the implement to dig the soil. And he said, "No, no, no, I'll use my hands." And she said he started throwing his hands into the soil and picking up the soil to put it in the jar, and his hands were turning black with the soil. And the way he was going about it with such intent moved her. And before she realized it, she had tears running down her face, and they were continuing, and the jar was getting near full. And she said when the jar got near full, the man had slowed down, and she looked at him, and his shoulders were shaking. And then she saw the tears running down his face, and she stopped, and she put her hand on his shoulder, and she said, "Are you okay?" And that's when the man said, "No, no, I'm not okay." He said, "I'm just so afraid that it was my father who participated in this lynching." And she said they both sat on the roadside, and he was crying, and she was crying. And then they finished, and he said to her, "I want to take a picture of you holding the jar." And she said to him, "I want to take a picture of you holding the jar." And they took these photographs, and they both came back to Montgomery to bring and present the jar to us. And for me, what's powerful about truth-telling is when we find the courage to tell the truth about our past, when we own up to the mistakes we've made, when we acknowledge the injustice that we have condoned and accepted, beautiful things can happen. They don't always happen, but beautiful things can happen. And we're denying ourselves the beauty of restoration, of reconciliation, of redemption, of reparation when we refuse to tell the truth about our past, which is why these sites and these projects and those jars represent something really powerful for me.
And your work reminds us that slavery and some of those other horrific events in history have a legacy for white people as well. The book and the movie show how so many people don't follow your grandmother's simple advice, do the right thing even when it's hard, and, you know, do the some of the wrongdoing and wrong decision making you see in 2020 still have roots in slavery?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's, you know, sometimes people hear me talking about history and all of these difficult times in American history, and they think I want to just punish the nation for that history. I have no interest in punishment. My interest is in liberation. I think we are all burdened. We are all injured. We are all harmed when we turn a blind eye to oppression and injustice and unfairness. I don't think we can be healthy if we are content to stand next to abuse and misconduct and injustice. And so I actually do think it's for all of us that we have to be willing to speak these truths. And yes, you can see the legacy of that era all around us. You know, in the United States today, the Bureau of Justice has projected that 1 in 3 black male babies born in this country is expected to go to jail or prisons. And we have problems in poor communities, but those problems are aggravated by a system that acts on these presumptions of dangerousness and guilt. We are a great nation, but we cannot be a great, fully great, until we recognize and have the courage, you know, to acknowledge these problems. I think, you know, personally and individually, we've most of us learned that you have to be willing to say, I'm sorry when you make a mistake. Collectively, I'm not so sure that that has been embraced. We have a political culture where too many of our elected officials think if they say, I'm sorry, they'll be weak. They'll be looked at as weak. I actually think your willingness to say, I'm sorry, is what allows you to be strong, to get strong. And collectively and individually, I think that's what's going to be required. And stories like Walter McMillan's, of a man wrongly convicted, wrongly condemned, threatened with execution for 6 years, is a great place to start in that reckoning, in that willingness to acknowledge wrongdoing. It's why I think we shouldn't be executing people anywhere in the world, but certainly in this country, with a history of enslavement and segregation and lynching and racial terror and violence.
I've been speaking with activist lawyer Brian Stevenson from the Equal Justice Initiative. His memoir is called Just Mercy, and it's now a film of the same name. Brian, a real pleasure to speak with you, and thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, I appreciate it. Great talking with you.